This is Cincy 360, about Cincinnati from Cincinnati, on ESPN 1530. Here's James Rapine and Mo Egger.
That's us. I'm James Rapine. He is Mo Egger. It is great to be with you on this Tuesday afternoon where the sun is shining, Mo. It's almost like the Bengals won on Sunday night, the way the sun is shining. How you doing?
I'm great.
Are you scrambling more now or... were you scrambling more 24 hours ago when you suddenly realized that your flight was not going to be until later, so it got canceled and you had to drive?
Of where I was at this point. So I was probably like an hour outside of Indianapolis. It is a miracle. I mean, I whizzed past. The Illinois State Police are very, very generous with how fast. Because, I mean, I whizzed past this like black police SUV, and I'm going 90 to 95, and it's 70, the speed limit. Just trying to get here. And I'm like, well, can I just talk him into writing the ticket quickly so I can get to work? So fortunately, he did not pull me over. I got here pretty much on time.
Yeah, you got here at like 3:15 yesterday. Yeah. Tony and I talked for just a few minutes, and then you dive in, and the podcast is up at ESPN1530.com. How long is that? Is it like 8 hours? That's what I was told.
It's an 8-hour drive. When I got in the car, the GPS said that I was going to get here between 3:45 and 4. It was 3:51 or something.
You zoomed.
And I'm like, there's zero chance that's going to happen. I had to stop to get gas one time. Other than that, I didn't go to the bathroom. I didn't eat. I really believe had I called it and said, look, I'll be here whenever I can get there, you and others would have been like, yeah, that's fine. I kind of took it as a personal challenge. I wanted to be here by the end of Marvin Lewis's press conference.
Yeah, I didn't even know that this was a thing, and you called me from the road. You're like, hey, by the way, the flight got delayed. I'll be there around 3:15, 3:20, hopefully. Yeah. I'm like, oh, well, did it get delayed or canceled?
It got canceled.
So it got canceled, and then they were going to give you a later flight that was way later.
They put
later.
Me on a flight at 6:46, and then when I complained about that, they said, well, we have one other flight we could put you on that leaves around noon, but there's only one direct flight, Kansas City to Cincinnati. They couldn't put me on that. Anything else would have gotten me here after 6 o'clock at night. So the other thing I was thinking about was calling we had to come on the air last week, mm-hmm. Soren Petro, who does a sports radio show in Kansas City, and just say, can I get a studio there, but there was only one later flight out of Kansas City. Just getting in and out of Kansas City is not easy.
Yeah, clearly
for,
not.
For like the most centrally located city in the United States, it's the world's smallest airport and just not a place that's easy to get in and out of.
Well, clearly the Bengals had trouble getting in and out of there, at least in and out of the end zone on Sunday night.
It did make me think about your friends at Ultimate Air.
Yes.
How convenient.
It was amazing. It was amazing. Literally ate dinner at 7 o'clock after going to Atlanta in the Mercedes-Benz mm-hmm. Stadium is amazing, which you saw last night on Monday Night Football. We will talk a little bit about Monday Night Football coming up in about 35 minutes or so. We have some Reds and David Bell to get to after he was introduced yesterday. But let's start with the game you were at, Mo, which, man, what a game to travel for. There was a lot that obviously you discussed yesterday, 3-6 with Tony. I was very critical yesterday on this show about Terrell Austin, and rightfully so, but very critical about Bill Lazor as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as bad as Terrell Austin's defense has been, I was listening to Bengals Line with Dave Lapham yesterday. The Bengals missed 18 tackles. 18. Think about the 18 missed tackles. That's not on Terrell Austin.
No.
I think in this, if you look at the numbers, would not be the case. I'm slightly more concerned about the offense right now than I am the defense. It's an offensive-driven league. You're going to have to score, knowing that this defense has its flaws. You have a franchise quarterback. You have A.J. Green. You have all these pieces. You have to be able to put up points against an historically bad defense through 6 weeks in the Kansas City Chiefs,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't do that. I know it's only 1 week, but I just it was a reminder of what the Bengals were, what it was like watching the Bengals in 2016 and 2017. And I don't like that reminder. I don't want to see that ever again this year.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid it might come back up. I know they didn't have Eifert and they didn't have Giovanni Bernard. At the same time, I expected way more from the Bengals offense. Are you more concerned? Which end of the ball, which side are you more concerned on?
Well, with the defense, there's specific areas that trouble me. And there's basically two. And these are kind of independent of tackling, but one of them has a lot to do with the tackling. One is Vontaze Burfict, who, look, we've spent... since the moment he got back, it feels like that's the only guy we've talked about. He has yet to make a play, right? I mean, for all the talk of what he got fined for and the dirty hits and should he be suspended, make a play. Mm-hmm. And in three games, he has yet to do so.
What has he brought?
Nothing. Nothing.
He's brought a headache.
For years, people have said, boy, he brings an attitude. Well, if he is, it's certainly not reflected in how aggressively this team plays.
Yeah. Did have you noticed the difference? And I thought that he would definitely instantly bring a change in energy.
Mm-hmm.
Through the first 4 weeks, it was kind of like, they're going through the motions a bit. Vontaze is going to change that. I don't think he's changed that at all.
No, not in the least. Not in the least. I mean, look, it's worth diving into, and I'm not equipped to do it here. Team gets off to a great start without him. 6-0 without Vontaze in 2015. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. He came back for game number 7 or number 8.
Yeah.
Got off to a great start without him. Okay, well, I don't want to say he's the reason why things went downhill, but they lost games with him, didn't lose games without him. They obviously missed him each of the last two seasons to start the year. But this year, they got off to a 4-1 start. They're 3-1 start. They're 1-2 with him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very loose correlation in all likelihood, but I think it's worth maybe somebody tapping into. But anyway, getting back to your original question, I worry about him not making plays because if he doesn't make them, who will? And number two, it's the lack of pass rush. I mean, 2.5 months ago, you and I were drooling over the possibilities for what this defensive line can do getting to quarterbacks. And it's not just sacks, okay? I know you could say, well, you know, guys are getting rid of the football so quickly. How about you bat down a ball at the line of scrimmage?
Can you make the opposing quarterback uncomfortable?
Well, and
that's it.
Ben Roethlisberger didn't get rid of the football quickly, and they never touched him. No. So we thought the strength of this team, not just this defense, was going to be this massive pass rush with all these guys. Haven't seen it. That said, it's the offense because there's no identity. Because it feels like they have no idea how to use guys. It feels like it looked like a Ken Zampezi run offense.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It looked and felt like we said with Ken Zampezi for 18 games, they have no idea how to use X or no idea how to use Y. It feels like they have no idea. They've determined that A.J. Green's going to be the slot guy from now on, which ignores the fact that he's one of the greatest wide receivers in the league and maybe the best in franchise history. And now we've kind of turned him into this slot possession guy. And that would be okay if you had a deep threat. I think they do in John Ross when healthy. It appears they have no idea how to use him. Tyler Boyd's had this big breakout season. I'll chalk what happened on Sunday night to just him having an off game that feels like they have no idea how to use Joe Mixon. And then, while this isn't their fault, you don't have Tyler Eifert. You're woefully now thin at tight end. A red zone threat has gone away. Giovanni Bernard's not on the field. The offensive line is never going to be good. And the quarterback is limited. For as well as he's played this season, he is limited. It's up to Bill Lazor to work with that and get more productivity than he did on Sunday against an awful defense, and he couldn't do that. So, yeah, for me, if it's one or the other, which one bothers me more? As a whole, it's the entirety of the offense.
I'm with you. And the problem I have with it is when I watched that team on Sunday, it did not look – and you always talk about this. Coaches, they're in the office and at the stadium grinding, working 16-hour days. What did the Bengals offense do differently? Seriously, what did they do differently or defensively? Honestly, what did that team do differently that it hadn't done in the first 6 weeks of the year? You knew you were going up against a high-powered offense. You knew you were going to have to score. You knew on defense that odds are you're going to have to force Pat Mahomes into a mistake or two. And while he did have one interception, the game was well over by the time he threw it. Like they didn't force any mistakes. Mm-hmm. They didn't find a way to get pressure on him. They had Sean Williams guarding Tyreek Hill, which anyone could tell you would never, ever be a good idea.
Right.
So that's defense. And then on offense, they didn't scheme it didn't seem like they had any design plays to get it to any of their playmakers, from Joe Mixon to John Ross to even A.J. Green. When A.J. caught the ball and he had 7 receptions and was obviously a bright spot at times, it felt difficult. It felt like it was hard to get him the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, if we're talking about this coordinator and we're on defense and Terrell Austin, and we're talking about Bill Lazor, and we're talking about an entire team that didn't look prepared for Sunday Night Football, and what was a game to literally give you a tie for the best record in the AFC. Mm-hmm. A win would have given the Bengals a tie for the best record in the AFC. It would have vaulted them among contenders, legitimate contenders to win and make a January playoff run, which is obviously something we've talked a lot about, and they look completely unprepared.
Mm-hmm.
Who does that fall on? It's got to be Marvin Lewis.
It's got to be Marvin. Common denominator.
It's Marvin. I can sit here and bash Bill Lazor all I want, and we can bash Terrell Austin all we want, but the team didn't look ready. They looked unprepared. That has to start with the head coach.
I think there's two things. Number one, it illustrates the most explosive this offense has been all season was against the Atlanta Falcons. Who accounted for three touchdowns that day? Giovanni Bernard and Tyler Eifert. Mm-hmm. Now, you're not getting Eifert back at all, unfortunately. And yes, he got injured during that game. But you saw in the first half, he beats his dude in the red zone. And I tweeted at the time, Eifert should have that all day. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he didn't get an opportunity. Gio that day had 96 yards from scrimmage. And Mixon didn't play, but had 96 yards from scrimmage and a couple of touchdowns. He was fantastic.
Yep. And he got dinged up on the final drive, too, or he would have had more yards.
So, okay, you're not getting Eifert back. You are getting Giovanni Bernard back. It tells me, and this is an overly simplistic way of viewing things, boy, you better get Giovanni Bernard back sooner rather than later, and you better feature him quickly because you don't know how to do it with Joe Mixon. And when your offense was at its best, Gio was at his best. So there's that. But it kind of feels like this Marvin Lewis thing, we always say a team, it's cliche, a team reflects the personality of its coach. Do we feel like Marvin is sometimes a little passive? Mm-hmm. Do the Bengals play passive?
Yes.
Okay.
They punt on 4th-and-1 against the Steelers.
Have the Bengals played passive for a while?
For the majority of 15 years.
Who are the two strongest personalities the Bengals have had coordinating offense or defense? Mike Zimmer, Hugh Jackson, mm-hmm. Not passive dudes. You know, I love to make fun of Hugh Jackson, and in some respects, I feel like Bill Lazor's done a better job because I've always felt like with Hugh, the offense was really about him. But mm-hmm. But you know what? He did have this personality that said, F it, here's what we're going to be. And same thing with Mike Zimmer to a large degree. Mm-hmm. Marvin doesn't have that personality. I don't know if Bill Lazor or Terrell Austin do. I don't think we know enough about either guy. But you watch their units play, you watch this team play, it lacks aggressiveness. We crushed, you mentioned the 4th-and-1, punting. That game on Sunday night, it just kind of felt like they said, well, you know, we can't use Joe Mixon. And oh, boy, that looks like maybe they'll take the deep ball away. And I mean, it just kind of feels like they always, for a long time now, they've allowed the other team to dictate what they are or aren't going to do. And that is the coach. I think maybe to a degree it's the quarterback. And maybe it's trickled down to the coordinators, or maybe the coordinators are hired with Marvin's personality in mind. But it's certainly a team that lacks aggressiveness, and that's something we have said about Marvin Lewis for a very long time.
He's Mo Egger. I'm James Erpine. This is Cincy 360. We do this every single weekday, noon to 1, here on ESPN 1530. We're going to dive into David Bell being introduced yesterday as the new Reds manager, their 63rd manager in team history. We'll discuss that coming up in just a few short minutes. But the Bengals, let's continue the conversation here for just a second. Mo, they're 4-3. Mm-hmm. I got tweets from fans, and I know it's Twitter, and we overreact, especially in the moment, but I can't believe this team is playing like this, and fans legitimately wondering how many more games they're going to win this year. Like, seriously.
It's fair. That's fair.
They played that bad on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So that team won't win any games this year.
No, a team that goes 4-12.
That team
and
is
Andy Benoit can take a victory lap.
Yeah, Andy Benoit of MMQB and everybody else that had him 4-12 will be like, yeah, see, I told you.
I bet you he's able to come on our show now.
That's right. But they're 4-3.
Right.
They're within percentage points of being in first place still in the AFC North. Mm-hmm. They have a chance against a Tampa Bay team at home. Beat them. You get to 5-3 before the bye. You can get healthy, healthier at least, with Giovanni Bernard potentially coming back, I assume, after the bye. All of those things can still happen. And I think in a perfect scenario, even the most optimistic Bengals fans would have taken 5-3 at the bye. They can still make a playoff run. Mm-hmm. They can still get to wherever you had them, where they had 9 or 10 wins, which I think a lot of optimistic fans had them right in that range.
Yeah.
All of that's still doable. I know Sunday was a huge letdown, but as long as they don't let it snowball and they can handle Tampa Bay, they're about where everybody would have expected them to be and on track for the playoffs.
I think that the Tampa Bay game is obviously huge. The game that kind of swings it for me is New Orleans. If I assume the Bengals win on Sunday, and that's a hell of an assumption.
Yeah, I'm not assuming that, but yes.
It's New Orleans coming out of the bye. You know, they're kind of hit or miss on the road. Mm-hmm. They did go to Baltimore and win on Sunday to their credit. Justin Tucker misses that PAT, which no one saw coming. That game sort of, to me, feels like it's going to swing it either way. I said before the season, 9-7. They got to go 5-5 to go 9-7. I think what happens is, and I got caught up in it, admittedly. They get off to a 4-1 start. You adjust your expectations a little bit. And in reality, that's such a small sample size that I think we kind of overreacted. This team, we know they're not as good as Kansas City. We know they're not as good as New England. I think deep down inside, we probably know they're probably not head and shoulders better than Pittsburgh or Baltimore. They're kind of in a jumbled mix with them, and it feels like the Steelers are trending upward. Yeah, I think we got. I think our expectations got skewed by the 4-1 start. Mm-hmm. If I would have said at the beginning of the year they're going to go into Tampa Bay 4-3, most people would have said, "Yeah, okay, well, who are they going to lose to?" And if I would have said Carolina, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, most would have gone, "Yeah, that sounds about right." Maybe swap out Carolina for Atlanta. They are in the grand scheme of things, kind of where we thought they'd be. But unfortunately, I think what's happened is the last two losses have sort of confirmed everybody's fears mm-hmm. about the coach and quarterback, because a lot of this team is different and much of this team could be better, should be better, and often has been. But last week, what was it? Decision-making, clock management, not calling timeouts, Marvin, Andy.
Coach, quarterback, yep.
Sunday night, as much as everybody was deficient except for AJ Green, Andy comes up small in
Andy
a huge game.
He was bad. 15 of 29.
Right.
He's bad.
Andy, in a game that demanded he be great, was not even good, and Marvin's team didn't look ready. I think what it does, hey, that's great. They're 4-3, but maybe they're 4-3 in spite of the coach and quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're 4-3, but yeah, here's why they can't get over the hump, because 14 and the guy on the sideline are going to keep you from getting there.
Yeah, yesterday I said the how matters.
Sure, yeah.
How they lost mattered. I don't really know anyone that legitimately thought they were going to beat Kansas City at Arrowhead. Even going into the year pre this Pat Mahomes, oh my gosh, they have the best offense in the NFL. Such a tough place to play. You knew they had some weapons. You knew they had a good coach. It was a tough ask.
Yeah.
You knew that when you booked your trip to Kansas City, you didn't assume you were going to see a win.
We bought a case of beer and a styrofoam cooler, and we walked looking for a Bengals tailgate. We found a Bengals flag. We ran into some very nice people, 8, maybe 10 folks. Mm-hmm. Everybody was like, dude, we're going to get boat raced. Nobody, like, there was, but it was like, all right, fine, we're here, let's see what happened. You're right, nobody had that expectation. But you're right, the how matters.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony said this yesterday, you've said it, if they lose 38-35, it's, you know what, offense match the challenge, and that team scores against everybody.
A perfect example. Do you think anyone in Kansas City ripped the Chiefs after they went to Foxborough and lost 43-40?
More people talked about the Chiefs
than they did the Patriots.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. They went in Gillette, and Pat Mahomes had 4 touchdown passes in the second half.
Yeah.
They tied the game up at 48. They took the lead.
No, reading all the Kansas City papers last week, the Kansas City Star on Wednesday, there was a column about how that was Pat Mahomes' moment, and he came up big. It was not about Brady comes up big, defense can't get a stop. No, it was, hey, we lost. But did you see what they did in that building against that coach and that quarterback?
Man, if they have to go there in January, they have a shot.
Absolutely.
Can you imagine how we're going to feel if the Bengals have to go to Arrowhead in the playoffs?
L.
And that's why the how matters. I will say, your expectations did not change. We sat in these chairs when they were 3-1, and you said they're going to go 2-2.
Yeah,
I remember you saying that. What?
Sometimes I want to be wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree. And they barely beat Miami. They handled it, though. I say barely. They took over in the fourth quarter.
I'll say this. This Sunday, there should be no emotional letdown because they didn't get emotionally high for the Kansas City game.
There better not be. Emotional letdown. They didn't even show up.
Yeah.
Bill Lazor didn't even bring his playbook.
Mm-hmm.
He brought his 2017 playbook. I cannot confirm
Ken Zampezi's?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
But offensively, that's what it felt like.
It was exactly like last year.
And so at some point, and we did this 10 and a half months ago, at some point you go, okay, keep swapping out coordinators. At some point, it's the head coach.
Yeah.
And for me, what you saw on Sunday was mostly reflective of him. And the way they lost to the Steelers was mostly reflective of him. And so I'm where I think a lot of Bengals fans are. Hey, it's cool. This team is more relevant than it was last year. They put themselves in the hunt. The AFC North probably doesn't have a great team, so maybe the Bengals can stay in that mix. But what's going to keep them from winning the kind of games that have eluded this franchise for 27 years are the coach and the quarterback.
And last thing here, and this was Lance tweeted it out, and All these people tweeted out and mentioned it. Pat Mahomes drafted 10th mm-hmm. in the 2017 draft. John Ross drafted 9th. I want to say one thing on that. I'm not sure if Pat Mahomes is the same quarterback if he's here. He probably isn't. But I will say this. I don't think the Bengals even were considering quarterback at 9th overall.
No, they're all in on Andy Dalton.
They weren't. And so...
And they had a backup quarterback at that time in A.J. McCarron that they valued.
So, one... There you go. There's your lesson. Maybe moving forward, the Bengals should look at that, and the Chiefs did it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
They won last year, and then they swap out with a first-round pick, swap out Alex Smith, get draft picks back in return for a guy who needed to be paid, and Alex Smith is a mediocre quarterback. He's fine, but he's not great.
Yeah.
And they continue to win.
Mm-hmm.
The Chiefs' blueprint is there. I'm not saying that the Bengals need to be concerned about it now, but if they go 9-7 this year and lose in the first round of the playoffs, maybe you look at the Chiefs' blueprint a little bit more. Mm-hmm. We talked about it with Lamar Jackson. Didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
That was a good blueprint to look at. The Bengals didn't. Maybe they'll consider it this offseason. I just wanted to take that.
If you're drafting in the top 10 and there's a quarterback that everybody has a top 10 grade on, you have to at least consider it. And I don't think the Bengals really did. You know, Marvin said last week, well, we liked him, but I'm going to guess.
He's not
going to
say they hated him.
I'm going to promise you. Yeah, he's not. I'm going to promise you, as the draft is unfolding and they're sitting there with the 9th pick, they weren't like, you know, the kid from Texas Tech. No, it was, we're going to take John Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole other set of issues.
Yeah.
But I just don't think they seriously considered him. And you know, you said it. I don't know that Pat Mahomes is Pat Mahomes playing for this team.
I don't even think he is. But that skill set. I'm shocked that he wasn't first.
I also feel like
and I know that's the Miles Garrett.
I feel
draft,
like he's
but.
With the perfect coach. Like,
he is.
I feel like he's with the perfect coach who says, look, we're gonna take some chances. We're gonna sort of put a lot on you. We're gonna let you unload it. You know, if you throw it deep and get picked off, you throw it deep and get picked off. I mean, you're gonna learn on the job here. I feel like Andy Reid is different than Marvin Lewis in that regard.
A lot different. He's Mo, I'm James. This is Cincy 360. Up next, David Bell is the new manager.
David Bell.
Of your Cincinnati Reds. We're going to discuss that, what it means for the Reds, and our thoughts on the hire in the Reds offseason coming up next. This is Cincy 360 on ESPN 1530.
Now Cincy 360 resumes. Brought to you by Safe Auto. Give us 3 minutes, save up to 25% on ESPN 1530, Cincinnati's sports station.
Welcome back into Cincy 360. Mo back at it today at 3:05. What do you got on the show today, Mo?
Dick Williams will be on the show with me at 4. We have our buddy Paul Daner Jr. He's going to join us an hour later than usual to talk about the Bengals. That coming up at 5:05. So I'm certainly looking forward to that. We'll continue to beat the Kansas City game to death. I do have.
Well, Kansas City beat the Bengals to death, so it's good that someone from Cincinnati's taking the beating back.
Very, very true. And I know we're going to talk about David Bell here in a second. There was something I really, really liked about what came from the Reds yesterday, and it really doesn't have that much to do with David Bell. So we'll get into that. And FC Cincinnati is getting set for another playoff game after Saturday's thriller. That was a whole lot of fun. And so I'm looking forward to talking about that. We're going to have on with us, and we're going to have FC Cincinnati guests all week long, just as we did last week. Blake Smith will be on the show at 3:33.
Can't wait for that. He's Mo Egger. I'm James Rapine. This is Cincy 360. We do it every single weekday, noon to 1. So David Bell gets introduced yesterday. And it kind of felt like throughout this process, and obviously he made the final three that came out last week, that he was one of the favorites. He was one of the names being mentioned. I know Lance posted a blog at ESPN1530.com saying Bell was his guy. There was the Joe Girardi factor as well. But overall, just my quick thoughts on Bell. One, Cincinnati likes their own, as most cities do, but certainly in the Midwest, that is a common theme.
Mm-hmm.
So why not bring in a Cincinnati native? Not that that is the reason you do it, but that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with bringing the Moeller product in, who won a state title in 89, especially since he's done a little bit of everything. Third base coach. He's worked in player development. He was a manager in the Reds minor league system for years. He's got a lengthy resume. I like the experience there. Obviously never been a major league manager. But overall, like this feels like the guy who, again, if you give him the talent, and we'll talk about it in a second, but if you give him the talent, he knows and he has the experience to do something with that. And there was never a point where I thought that Brian Price or Jim Riggleman was that guy. Call me crazy, call me overreactionary, but I think that David Bell at least has the resume coming into this job where I could see that happening down the line at some point when the Reds are actually decent.
Well, Price, I didn't really care what his resume was because he had no chance to ever win, so it didn't matter to me. He just kind of felt like a placeholder, and Riggleman has an extensive managerial experience background, but that just kind of to me felt like an extension of what happened previously. I think it's a little myopic to suggest the Reds hired him because he's a Cincinnati guy. I think if you didn't know that, if you didn't know where he was from and you looked at playing experience, managing experience, minor league experience, front office experience, you go, you know what, that guy's got a pretty good background. Let's give him a shot. Is he going to succeed? I have no idea. Am I excited about it? I'll be excited about it when I feel like he's got a pitching staff that's capable of giving him a chance to succeed. But in terms of background, I was more concerned all year long about, number one, don't be slave to that 3-week stretch in June and July when they played well and, you know, pull the trigger on Jim Riggleman. Don't do that. Go through a thorough, exhaustive search. See Trent Rosecrans for The Athletic documented in great detail exactly how thorough and far-reaching this search was. Start it with a list of 90 guys.
Fantastic. You think Dusty Baker was on that list?
No. I said all along, I just want you to go through your first thorough and exhaustive search in over a decade for this job, because they really didn't with Brian Price. It was basically, hey, do we have Brian's updated phone number? Let's call him. He's the manager. So I wanted them to do that. And then whoever they arrived at that point, it was going to be cool with me. Even if it was Jim Riggleman, that wouldn't be my first choice, just because, again, let's bring some new blood in. But if at the end of an exhaustive search, whoever it was, fine, awesome, tell me how you're getting the pitching better.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is far more important and interesting, frankly, than anything the Reds do in hiring a manager. But for David Bell, yeah, I'm on board. I'm in. But let's equip him to succeed better than we did the last two guys.
Yeah, I think that the Reds certainly deserve credit for going through this exhaustive search. They did not took their time with this. They did not rush to anything.
Right.
It went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and they interviewed all these candidates, 12 that we know of, right? I believe it was 12. And then they went to the next round of interviews and the next round. And I will say this, when it comes to someone like David Bell, and naturally he did not get this job because he's a Cincinnati native. I'm not saying that at all. I just think it's a bonus for fans to say that, especially if he has success. But if he didn't feel like the Reds had the resources and the people in place to get the pitching, to get the roster where it needs to be to set him up for success, with his resume, he might not have gotten a manager job this year. He would have been a candidate for the next couple of years. And at some point, he would have gotten a shot. So I know it's home, and I know his ties to the organization and all of that stuff. But I think that it says something about Dick Williams and Nick Kroll and this Reds organization that they were able to convince him that, hey, you can come here. You're not going to be another Brian Price. You're not going to be a placeholder. You're not going to be a guy that is just dealing with lackluster talent. We're going to get you the talent and put you in a position to have success. Obviously, I think fans are more interested in that. And I think that says a lot about the Reds organization. Now, will they go do that? I'm not sure. But if you convince David Bell, who's been around baseball his entire life, that they're going to do that, I think that that's a good start.
I downplay that a little bit just because, for the most part, managerial jobs that come open are on bad teams. There's obviously exceptions. Boston and New York both hired different managers, the Yankees and Red Sox specifically, although I guess the Mets did as well. They hired different managers than ones that managed them in the playoffs last year. But, I mean, look at the openings. Toronto, not good. Texas, awful. Baltimore, almost historically bad. Reds, bad. So I tend to look at the whole like, well, he could have waited. Yeah, but these are the kind of jobs that come open. Teams coming off losing seasons, teams that have been losing for a while. So that I kind of downplay. There was something, though, I think relatively significant about what David Bell said. And I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he talked about being aligned with the front office. And the last two managers, permanent managers, not Jim Riggleman, I kind of felt like the last two managers weren't always in concert with whatever the front office was doing, whether it was Dusty and Walt Jocketty, Brian Price and Walt Jocketty, Brian Price and Dick Williams. With Dusty, it never really felt like they were on the same page. If you remember, his parting shot out of town was, well, we didn't get anybody at the deadline. Marlon Byrd hit a home run against us in the wild card game, and that was somebody I would have liked. It illustrated, and then there were other little sort of moments during his tenure where you kind of wondered, are Dusty and Walt on the same page? Is Dusty and ownership, are they on the same page? And then Brian Price, about 15 months ago, was talking about, hey, next year we need to go get some pitchers in free agency. What happened this year? They didn't get any.
He was right, by the way.
He was dead on right, but there was a gap, I think, between the manager and the front office. David Bell talked about that at relative length yesterday about how, look, I've got to be aligned. I've got to learn more about what they do. I've got to embrace maybe some of the information they're working with, which is a nod to analytics. I think that's really, really important. That is really important. So that to me was significant. But the overall sort of like, how do you feel about this? It's like with Brian Price. I said at the time, it just kind of feels to me like no matter who this guy's not set up for success. David Bell right now, as of this moment, is set up to lose 90 games next year. At this moment, mm-hmm. he's going to lose 90. Now, that may change in the next month, may certainly change in the next 4 months. But I want to, when they go into spring training in mid-February, I want to say about David Bell, Red's got a new manager who's finally set up to be judged by how many games he wins. I certainly don't think they're going to the playoffs next year. I don't believe they're going to be a 500 team next season. But I'd like to feel like this guy has a better chance at succeeding than I did at any point during the Brian Price era.
Yeah, my expectation, and maybe this is unfair, but I just think this is where we should be at this point in the rebuild. Whatever they add, and it needs to be a significant additions, starting pitchers, notably, right? Whether it's two or three or however many they would need to add, quality ones. If they do that, and they add, you know, maybe an outfielder, do something there as well, and that might be as easy as Nick Senzel. Who mm-hmm. knows? Maybe they trade him. Maybe he's the center fielder of the future. But if they can make necessary moves, I want to feel like in April, and I haven't felt this way in the past 5 years, that they can win 81 games. I want to say, all right, new manager, mm-hmm. New ace, or new number one who's starting on opening day that isn't Homer Bailey. Mm-hmm. Luis Castillo is your third or fourth guy in that rotation. And if things go well, this team can be a 500 team. I didn't feel that way last year. I know a lot of fans did. I just didn't see the talent there, and naturally, it wasn't there.
Yeah.
So hopefully, and that would be a 14-win improvement. I mean, that's a lot to ask, mm-hmm. right? That's a tall order there just to get the 500. But I want to feel like best case scenario, they can get there going into 2019. Hopefully they can do it with the moves they make.
The onus is on Dick Williams. I mean, to me, you know, Bob Castellini said something and C. Trent Rosecrans tweeted about it. I wrote about it for The Athletic. Bob Castellini was emphatic. We will get the pitching. And he's also said rather emphatically, we're going to spend more money than ever before. Now, that to me is not that important. Number one, they have a lot of guys who are going to get pay raises. Number two, I'm more interested in how you spend it than how much you spend. But it is significant. To me, all this gets thrown on Dick Williams now. Okay, you got your manager. You got a chance to go through your first cycle hiring a guy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get three or four of them. Typically, you get one or two. So, all right, you got your manager. You had forever to figure out who it was going to be. They're going to spend more money. You're going to have maybe the license to actually go get a free agent pitcher. You've been told, I think the mandate has been handed down from ownership, get the pitching. Now, that's not just free agency. It's trades. It's international market.
Mm-hmm.
It's developing your own guys. But to me now, like, this gets thrust on Dick Williams. All right, you've been in the job. I know he got bumped up this year, but you've basically been the guy in charge for a number of years now. The rebuild has plodded along. You got your manager. You're going to be given some more money. Dude, we're not giving you 5 years to figure this out,
no.
Okay? So, to me, now the onus is squarely on him. And I think Bob Castellini has put the onus squarely on Dick Williams. He's got to get out of his way. I've been screaming about that forever. If Dick Williams wants to trade Billy Hamilton because it makes the team better, you got to let him. If he wants to trade Scooter Gennett because it's going to make the team better, you got to let him. If Dick Williams doesn't want to bring back Matt Harvey, but the owner loves him, Dick Williams has to win here. You
totally
have
agree.
To give him a chance, but to me, everything that happened yesterday was about saying, all right, your manager's in place. You're getting more cash to spend. Go do something that puts us in a better position to win than we've been in a very long time.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think that they should trade Billy Because that's going to open up some money.
If he's going to make $6 million next year, I can't justify that.
No, because he should be your fourth outfielder. I mean, he should not be your starting
even,
center fielder.
Even if you just said, Phil Irvin's going to play.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Irvin, not as good with the glove, better with the bat, is going to cost a little bit more than $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
From a value standpoint, that's better. Mm-hmm. Now, I tend to think they're looking beyond Phil Irvin to see who the next center fielder is going to be, but you're going to pay Billy Hamilton, who could walk at the end of next year. You're going to pay him $6 million, which is kind of the rough estimate of the arbitration figure he's going to get. I can't do it for a guy that's an offensive zero.
No.
I just can't.
I can't, especially when what has been the one, there's going to be some guys getting raises, including Scooter Gennett,
sure.
It feels like he's going to be back.
Mm-hmm.
So you're already doing that. You're going to spend more money, and you want to get the starting pitching? There you go.
Yeah.
There's $6 million that you can essentially cut and get something of value for, maybe, for Billy Hamilton.
But therein lies the most interesting thing. What's he worth on the open market?
Correct. And I don't know if it's as simple as packaging him in a deal for whoever. And it also potentially clears a spot for Nick Senzel in center field,
mm-hmm.
which I think would be really, really interesting. And that lineup, if you get Senzel at center with Jeanette and Suarez and Votto, who I think is going to have a bounce back here, you heard it here first.
Mm.
I think it's a pretty darn good lineup. You agree?
Well, they've had a good lineup the last 2 years.
I think it's even better, though.
I think Senzel, look, vertigo, finger issue, elbow issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's just since May.
I'm concerned, no doubt.
The time he's put into, he would be putting into learning to play the outfield more has been compromised by the injury. So, but yeah, look, he is their top prospect. At some point, you're going to see him, and he's probably an offensive upgrade from Billy Hamilton. You do like this team's ability to score runs. They do have a little bit of a surplus of outfielders. I think it would be interesting to see if there was a market for Jesse Winker or Scott Schebler. I think it would be interesting to see if there was a market for Scooter Gennett. Obviously, you know, you're sort of betting on Joey Votto being better, and I think that's a fair bet. I'm with you. I think dude is going to lock himself in the lab mm-hmm. for 4 months and come back, and you're not going to recognize him.
Mm-hmm.
But they've scored a lot of runs the last 2 years. They've lost 94 and then 95 games.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, it's as simple as go get Dallas Keuchel, go add an arm. All right.
There's one. It needs to be multiple.
And
it can't just be Dallas Keuchel.
And so to me, like, the onus is still on the guys they have. Now, who in that mix is in this rotation next year? They're not going to have five new starting pitchers.
I would say Castillo and DeSclafani have the...
Castillo, DeSclafani.
The inside track
yeah.
of it being two of the guys.
Right. Disco, does he stay healthy?
Mm-hmm.
Castillo, does he take a step forward? But it's not like, you know, you got the Homer Bailey question.
And if those are starters three and four, let's say you had two guys that are at the front end,
mm-hmm.
and Castillo's three, that's pretty good.
Yeah, you got the Homer Bailey question.
Yeah.
Does Matt Harvey come back, and how good is he? And then this collection of dudes from Malley to Sal Ramon, all those guys. I mean, that's a lot to sort through. This is going to be a fascinating offseason.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, you kind of knew what the offseason was going to be like. Number one, throughout baseball, no one made any moves. Number two, the Reds really weren't in a position. They were still sorting things out. Well, I think we've kind of done that. Now,
mm-hmm.
now this offseason, like hiring the manager, I think is going to be like the seventh most interesting thing that happens this offseason.
I hope so.
Because if it's
on the top three,
that's a problem.
They're in trouble.
Yep.
He's Mo, I'm James. This is Cincy 360. Real quick before we get to quick hits. In the NFL, let's switch gears for a second. In the NFL yesterday, New York Giants head coach Pat Shurmur goes for two, down eight.
Love it.
The day before, Mike Vrabel goes for two.
Love it.
Down one in London. You love both. I'll push back in a second, but go ahead and tell me why you love it.
Well, the Shurmur thing is, I kind of separate two. Vrabel, I'm a
completely
big
different. They're both different.
I'm a big fan of not coaching scared. Vrabel made that decision and stood by it after the game, even though it didn't work. You don't know if you're going to get the football back. 2-point conversion, the success rate is around 50%. Why not?
Here's the thing.
And they had two shots to go for it because there was a penalty that nullified the first chance.
Here's the thing for me with Vrabel. And I would have probably went for it there, too. One, you're in London.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you don't have as good of a team.
Right.
He knows that.
Yes.
He's no dummy. The Chargers are really, they might be the first or second or third best team in the AFC. I mean, they're in the top tier of AFC teams in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the case, and you're the Titans and you can steal one in London,
mm-hmm.
try to steal it.
Right.
So I don't blame him. Now, the play call was a little weird.
Play call was bad, and you separate the two, but like, I'm a fan of, if I never get the ball back, I'm going to try to take a lead.
Mm-hmm.
Overtime, you're putting yourself at the mercy of a coin flip. You're putting yourself at the mercy of just giving them the ball back before overtime. There's a lot there. So I was a fan of it. Last night, it's simple math. You pull within eight. If you go for two and you get it, now you're 7 points away from winning the game. And if you don't, you have another chance. Again, the success rate of two-point conversions is roughly 50%. The exact figure I don't have in front of me, but it's roughly 50%. You got to make one of two. I have no issue with it whatsoever. Now, later in the game, their clock management with a guy who's been playing quarterback in the NFL for a decade and a half, inexcusable.
Mm-hmm.
But the decision to go for two, totally on board.
Pat Shurmur said after the game that it would have been, if they went for it, it would have increased their chances of winning the game if they had gotten the two-point conversion by 50%.
I agree.
And it makes sense because you get two shots to go for two.
Mm-hmm.
And minimum, you're going to tie it. But if you get it, that's it. You go ahead. You get two opportunities to do it. So it does make sense. And I think it's going to be very interesting. We talk about analytics in baseball, and you just mentioned with David Bell, mm-hmm. how being in sync with the front office is so important. Analytics is going to start to take over this NFL.
More, oh, it already has.
But to a greater extent than we've ever seen it before. We're going to see more fourth down go for it. More teams go for it on fourth down. More teams go for it for 2-point conversions.
Hmm.
And the interesting, and not that we already haven't, but it's going to continue. That's what is going to be interesting is because these coaches that have the old ball coaches who have been coaching for 30 years, how are they going to embrace it or how are they not? And how big of a behind the eight ball from a draft process? I mean, think about it. Analytics are used everywhere, mm-hmm. draft, free agents, etc. If Marvin doesn't embrace that, how much does it set the Bengals back? So I think that's very interesting.
Let me try to figure out the best way to articulate this. In 2014, the Hail Mary game where Andy hits A.J. Green in the end zone in Baltimore.
Totally should have went for it.
They kick an extra point. They make it. They go to overtime and lose. I tweeted as soon as he caught that pass.
You did.
Go for two. And I talked about it the next day on the air extensively. Rocky Boyman was doing the show on Mondays with me at the time. And I got one of two responses. I got the response from, and I don't say this insultingly, just sort of like hardcore, old school, not really wanting to embrace the analytics football fan. And then I got responses from people that kind of looked at it mathematically and they said, yeah, you're right.
They were on the road.
Right.
They had been outplayed all day and they suddenly had a chance to win the game.
You're on the road, okay? Vegas says on the road, you're a 3-point underdog before they set the line. So to play another quarter, you're an underdog on the road. So there's that. There's the coin flip. You're at the mercy of the coin flip. You might not ever touch the football. And to me in that moment, it was, you know, all these things are kind of anecdotal. Baltimore scrambling. They just gave up a Hail Mary in a game they had cinched. Dude, take advantage of the fact that they're shocked.
Mm-hmm.
And had he done that, I'd have had no problem with it. Now, he kicked the PAT. They went to overtime. I don't even remember how they
lost. They
lost 23-20.
I believe.
There's no guarantee you're going to get the ball back. You are on the road. That's a situation where I would have loved it had Marvin said, you know what, from an analytical standpoint, this makes sense to do it. I'm going to get second-guessed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get crushed. Booger McFarland last night on TV was hammering Pat Shurmur for going for two. I would have loved it if Marvin said, you know what, the hell with that. We're going to take our shot at winning the game right here. And if the pass is incomplete or you don't score. I also do kind of feel like teams get a little weird with their two-point conversion plays. Remember the playoff game here?
They treat them differently than a fourth and goal from the two.
Yes.
It should be treated like any other fourth and goal from the two
right.
that you need to get.
Right. It feels to me, again, Bengals up 16-15 against the Steelers, Hugh Jackson, without A.J. Green even on the field,
mm-hmm.
calls this weird-looking play where it's like, man, you haven't run that all year.
There shouldn't be a two-point conversion play.
No,
our fourth down play that we're going to go
yes.
to. Here's our 10 plays, the two trick plays, and, you know, that's what it should be.
Right.
I agree with
now,
you. Teams overthink that.
I forget which quarterback I heard say, I forgot who it was, but he's like, you know, he goes, our two-point conversion, something about, you know, the reason we don't do it in the preseason is we have two-point conversion plays. And I'm going, well, surely you have more than two goal line plays. Why is there a difference?
That's crazy. I have no idea.
Why is there a difference?
So you're saying Marvin needs to think outside the box and embrace analytics.
Pat Shurmur's team is 1-6 and he's getting hammered. And I want Marvin to be more like him.
He's Mo. I'm James. This is Cincy 360 next.
And by the way, really quick, I know there's a lot of people who love Mike Vrabel. Like, I want Marvin's team to play the way Mike Vrabel's team does.
Mm-hmm.
They're not that talented. But
they're aggressive.
They're very, very aggressive.
Up next, could the Bengals think outside the box before October 30th in the trade deadline? Or on October 30th?
Mm.
We'll get to that and so much more during Quick Hits A Cedric Abue, he mentioned, is ahead on ESPN 1530.
Cincy 360 continues on ESPN 1530, Cincinnati's sports station.
I'm James Hiesmo, and this is Cincy 360. A quick reminder that you can listen to Cincy 360 and Mo's show 3 to 6 anywhere you go on the iHeartRadio app. Every show podcasted at ESPN1530.com.
It's time for Cincy 360 Quick Hits on ESPN 1530.
Quick Hits is a service of Rumpke Restoration. Do you have water damage or need your carpets cleaned? Maybe a flooded basement has left a mess. Go to RumpkeRestores.com. Mo, the trade deadline in the NFL is October 30th. And CBS Sports mentioned Bengals offensive lineman Cedric Olehi, Obuehi, as a potential trade candidate. Your thoughts?
Why would anybody want him? What can I get for him? A new tackling dummy? One of those pads for the goalpost? A couple of new chin straps?
A copy of Madden.
What do you get for Cedric Abue?
Copy of Madden.
I will, to borrow from my guy Lance, I will gas up my Jeep and drive Cedric Abue to his new destination.
Call the Cowboys. Not only did they make a trade yesterday, but their offensive line coach is very, very fond of Cedric Olehi.
Give him to Paul Alexander.
Speaking of the Cowboys and Paul Alexander, they traded for Amari Cooper yesterday. They're getting torched for this. I didn't think the trade was that bad. You get an established player for a first-round pick. I think draft picks a little overrated.
I think draft picks are overrated, and the NFC East stinks. It's wide open with three teams all sort of huddled in the middle. Obviously, Washington beat Dallas. But, yeah, if I was a Cowboys fan, I would totally, totally be on board.
Yeah, I'm with you. Do it. Get an established commodity for Dak Prescott. Figure out what he is. Let's go locally here where UK is number two in the first NCAA Associated Press Top 25 college basketball
poll. Yeah, some people surprised they weren't ranked number one in the country, which who cares. But you look at their schedule, you will find five top 11 teams on their schedule, including two SEC teams. Mm-hmm. SEC is going to be dynamite this year. Kansas 1, Gonzaga 3, UK and Duke 2 weeks from tonight in Indianapolis on the opener of the college basketball season, 2-4. The game, the World
Can't
Series.
Can't wait for that, by the way.
Begins tonight, James, at Fenway Park in Boston. Who do you got, Dodgers or Red Sox?
I got Red Sox. I hope it goes 7. I love that it's Los Angeles-Boston because I just think ratings are going to be booming for baseball, and that's good for baseball. So I love that idea. I hope it goes 7, though. The last thing I want to see is like a 4-game or a 5-gamer that isn't entertaining. Baseball needs this, and they need. I want a repeat of what happened a couple of years ago with Chicago and in Cleveland. I want that right there.
That's exactly
7 games.
That's exactly what I want, which we had last year. I got the Dodgers in 7 for two basic reasons. What's huge in baseball right now? Mm-hmm. Home runs. The Dodgers hit more. Bullpenning. The Dodgers have a better one. And as much as people crush Clayton Kershaw for his postseason performances, his last outing against Milwaukee, he was flat out dealing. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is a huge X factor. I know they don't have home field, but I got L.A. winning in 7.
Could you imagine 3 straight Game 7s?
Would be awesome.
It would be.
Yes.
I keep mentioning that.
Last year's Game 7 was kind of anticlimactic.
That's why I mentioned Cleveland and Chicago.
That was
because
fantastic.
Literally it was must-see TV in like the 11th inning or 10th inning or whatever it went to, and David Ross and the good and the bad and stuff. So I loved it. Yesterday, LeBron choked at the free throw line with his team up 1 in overtime, misses 2 free throws. Then they lose. They go on to lose to San Antonio.
There's three things about that game. I watched a lot of it, and I wouldn't say most was fantastic. Number two, LeBron was great. Number three, he's a 74% free throw shooter for his career, which is kind of inexcusable. Number four, they are horrific defensively.
Bad defensively, and I cannot trust, I've said this for years, I cannot trust LeBron James at the free throw line with the game on the line.
You have said that for
years. It worries the heck out of me. And I wouldn't say that about other greats in that realm, from Jordan to Kobe. Now, I'm not saying that LeBron isn't as good as those guys. I'm just saying that I worry about him at the free throw line with the game on the line in yesterday's watch.
What I can't wait for is the Golden State Warriors taking on the Lakers, because with the ease with which Jacob Evans scored his first career bucket last night against Phoenix, he might go off for 30 points against the Lakers. Congratulations to Jake for his first NBA bucket.
Mo back at it today at 3:05. The Stephen A. Smith Show is next. I'm James Rapine. Thanks for listening today on ESPN 1530.